You're listening to All Things Cage at Wavefarm Radio's WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Executive Director of the John Cage Trust, and my guests today are Pascal Georgiev and Kingston Trinder, principals at Atelier Editions, a limited edition publishing house who number among their most recent publications, John Cage, A Mycological Foray. Before I welcome our guests, let me play an excerpt drawn from a public performance John Cage gave of his Mushrooms e Variaciones, one of two original text pieces by him that are included in this beautiful and lavishly illustrated publication.
This is an introduction. In the fall of 1983, I was invited by Ray Cass to Mountain Lake in Virginia to conduct a mushroom foray with real mycologists, Arson K. Miller Jr. and his wife, Hope H. Miller. I myself am just an amateur. One evening, I was to give a talk bringing together my devotion to the arts and my love of mushrooms. I decided to write a new text in the same way that I had written themes and variations, but the new one would not be as themes and variations is, misostics on the names of people who have been important to me in my life and work. It would be misostics on the Latin names of mushrooms. That's why the title is partly in Latin. Mushrooms that I have enjoyed collecting in the woods and fields and later eating in the evening at dinner with friends. I wrote a library of misostics, five different ones on each of 12 mushroom names, repeated five times, 60 texts in all, each one setting out from a chance-determined one of the 110 ideas I'd listed in the course of a cursory examination of my books. Then using I Ching chance operations, I used these 60 syntactical texts to make one which was non-syntactical, a Renga, since it came from a plurality of sources rather than a single one, and since it is long rather than short, like haiku. Mushrooms et Variationes is one more in an ongoing series, writings which, though coming from ideas, are not about them, yet nevertheless unintentionally produce them. More time is given to misostics on the name Craterellus cornucopioides than to the others because of the letterist events which are to be vocalized or pronounced halfway between speech and song. These letterist events were triggered by the idea love, one of the 110 ideas mentioned above. I've noticed that when people are in love, they are frequently perfectly happy together, making no sense at all. This evening, as you know from your programs, the percussion group from Cincinnati is playing a piece in memory of Jean Arp while I read the text. Instead, between that two deal more becoming and after, not lying between, instead of in latter case both, I'm every atom because relationship between them takes working fact, both only when they're on track, as much in space always but now, formed, written emptiness, ready to receive, upsets what's had in mind. Each there's now enlightened is worthy. Less shall I do. I remember passivity, acceptance of being at one center, foot of land, continued by listing every plant she found. Much gravity aspect of energy she had written in, motor enlightened, now and more and then. We believe he found miserable thee. Shift very you are like my conversation at table, gone to the movies, its name direction that came up with lovely sounds in nature to block out the wouldn't let them the urban leader once more ready for no matter what.
So welcome Pascal and Kingston from a rather nippy Montreal. Did you ever think that John Cage himself would open for you?
I think that's it's a beautiful echo of the what became the privileged way we found ourselves immersed in the John Cage world. He's the introduction to every single kind of element that we've brought in, literally from even the book itself to Mushroom Book. There's always words by Cage or his voice or something of his that kind of is the catalyst, I suppose. So it's a nice way to find ourselves.
Perhaps being sort of introduced by the sort of sort of omniscient spirit of Cage is an extraordinary honor.
Yes.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Good on you, mate.
I thought that we might begin because it strikes me that this book that we're going to be talking about, The Mycological Foray, like many of the books that Atelier has put out, is very much a product of your interest in archival materials. So can you share a little bit about the beginnings of the project and how you ended up at the John Cage Trust?
Great question. So originally, Laura Pascal and I, neither of whom are from Southern California, we're living in Los Angeles, and we'd come across a couple of magazine articles, I think, or sort of asides, if you will, that indicated John Cage had an enduring interest in mycology. And one afternoon in a sort of, you know, Wikipedia rabbit hole haze, Pascal and I discovered that the John Cage mycology collection was held at the University of California, Santa Cruz, which, you know, if you live in Los Angeles, Santa Cruz doesn't feel a million miles away, although, of course, it's quite a drive. And we decided then and there that because we're often very interested in sort of anecdotal asides, particularly I think about, that concern artists and individuals whose lives and earth are well examined, to sort of note an idiosyncratic note perhaps amongst a reasonably well-known narrative. And we thought let's hasten up there and take a look at the John Cage mycology collection. And in the course of that, obviously, we discovered that that's only one facet of John Cage's mycological interests, arguably the more ephemeral part in some respects. And as all John Cage roads lead to Laura Kuhn of the John Cage Trust, inevitably we found ourselves in wherever you are, in upstate New York, New York State, and came tumbling down from Brisk, Montreal for a conversation with you and Emmy about the John Cage mycology collection.
I see. You know, I'm not sure if I've ever told you this, but that particular archive is the least known of all the Cage archives.
Right.
So you entered our world through this very, it's almost not a secret, but it's just a quiet place. It's a very quiet place in the Cage world.
Right.
Yeah, it feels really that way as well. When we were there at the university's library, it just felt very, not that it was unvisited, but it felt unexpected for the staff there to have us kind of digging around these boxes and looking in, Kingston used the word anecdotal. It's one that we we use purposefully, but we know that it is often misread. You know, but we do like these sidebars and asides. The word marginalia often comes up when we're building projects, and it's very much kind of a window into our personalities and where we've merged in terms of bookmaking as well. But that's kind of what we felt like we were emerged in, was this little dusty box that might have exactly the magic kind of piece that was missing to build a project from it. And it didn't mean that things hadn't been visited over the years. A lot of the boxes seem to have been pulled out for other reasons during that time. But there was this kind of idea that there was a mass of ephemera that had interwoven through it a story that we had to kind of really extrapolate from all of the material, and then through coming to meet with you and Emmy and Red Hook.
I think to add to that, Laura, the sort of the collection at the McHenry Library, it felt a little bit like, I mean, here's a literary analogy, but it felt like it's sort of C.S. Lewis's wardrobe door. And that's how we entered the sort of Michael at the landscape of John Cage's mind and thoughts, was through this quite sort of bizarre door in the University of Santa Cruz. It's
an incredible campus as well. We're really talking about like a place to kind of say, hey, we're going up to San Francisco for work anyways. You know, we were up there for a book fair and a few meetings, and we were like, why don't we tag on a few days in Santa Cruz? I had spent some time there, you know, a few years prior for photo shoot purposes, which is a very different way to approach Santa Cruz, because you spend your time outdoors looking for, you know, magic hour and all these different things and the surf's up kind of vibe. And then you don't realize that just up the hill, walking distance, is this incredible redwood forest filled with these students that are kind of this merge of two worlds, because you have the surf's up vibe and the kind of forest magical space, and the campus is so sprawling and natural. And it's something that, you know, in city living in Montreal as a young person, I really didn't get access to these types of campuses. And I don't think your campus
New Zealand.
I mean, in terms of these kind of like, it feels like a secret, beautiful campus that's just off of a city. And it was something that was really interesting for us to find material in as well, because we're used to maybe something that's a little bit more structured.
Right.
Two is the fact that we obviously found this, you know, down as the project developed, but in some ways we'd almost come full circle to the genesis in some ways of Cage's own mycological interest by returning, if not to the Monterey Peninsula and certainly in Carmel, but certainly, you know, in the region. Mm. Felt like a nice sort of cyclical return in a way.
Sure. I think he felt very close to that part of the state.
Right. Mm.
And, you know, he was born in the Los Angeles area, in LA proper, actually, but he then was in Northern California for quite a bit. He had friends in up near Yreka and Eureka, both, which is much further up. And, you know, I never asked him, and I wonder, is there anyone left at the UCSC campus in the McHenry Library in particular, who knew Rita Bottoms, who knew the way that collection had come together?
Not that we were told.
I think they were aware of you know, how things were historically, but we didn't have that many tales. Let's put it that way. It was a totally welcoming space, and we went through it quite nicely, but no, we didn't hear much of the historical aspect, other than the kind of grandling, as they say, the bullet points, and then it's with you that we kind of found out a little bit more about it.
I think to add to that too, Laura, obviously when we began our conversations with you and Red Hook, it felt more, you contextualized that collection much more so for us.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I never asked Cage. I wouldn't have had a reason to, and then he died, and now I can't. But, and Rita is long retired.
Right. So,
and I never knew Rita. In fact, I never had any conversation with her until she put out her little book. She wrote a book called Rifts and Ecstasies. Very small. And it just really devotes one page or so to each of the sort of infamous people that she met. It has a foreword by Ferlinghetti. It's a funky little book, but it's very sweet. And she reached out to me and said, did we want a copy for the archives? And I said, you bet. She was very colorful to hear Cage tell. But what I didn't ask Cage was, who reached out to whom? You know, did she come to him and say, you know, we would be willing to take X from you? Or did he look for a home for those materials? I think I told you both that the my experience with the materials in the three spaces that we think of as the principal, really the principal archives.
Right.
Not the John Cage Trust, because we came later, but in Cage's lifetime, there was Wesleyan University Press, so Wesleyan University Library, because of his publication relationship with them, and they took anything having to do with humanities, and that would include all the materials that were outtakes or preparatory for publication of his books. So we, since he's died, I have come across some really stunning stuff there, given that he would submit it to be in one of his anthologies, which they all were, all of his books, and they were rejected for whatever reason. You know, there was an editor and they chose from whatever he sent, but those things didn't come back. Right. So they lived, they just stayed there. So it wasn't until, you know, several years after he died that I went up there and poked around and, you know, found all these little lovely things, some of which are published at johncage.org, you can see. Some of the things that I found there are quite lovely. But anyway, my point is simply that those materials all had to do with humanities. New York Public Library, not New York, New York Public Library, Northwestern University took everything related to music, and UCSC took everything related to nature, which of course included mushrooms.
Right.
But my experience with what went there was really, you used the word ephemera, Kingston, and it was perfect because that's what John called them. Ephemera. So we had these transfer boxes in the closet, and as, for lack of a better way to put it, sort of junk mail came in the house. Notices about poetry readings, you know, magazines of all kinds, things like that. They would get thrown in these boxes, depending on which topic or which subject they came closest to. And then when they got full, literally when they got full, we would sort of rearrange them neatly and pack them up and send them off. So that's what I envision all of those places as being, these boxes of stuff that we had thrown into these, you know, into chaos, into these boxes. Well, but from looking at your book, from looking at Mycological Foray, there's a lot more there. So at some point they began to solicit, they begin to acquire. There was an acquisition effort, apparently. Is that your sense?
Yep.
I just wanted to add something very briefly, Laura. I think it concerns the idea around archives and archiving, which is more often than not, right, objects on ephemera and, you know, someone's possessions, they acquire a kind of post-death significance, a posthumous significance, right? And
of
you
course.
Can see the junk mail, which is very apt, in the sense that an archive in some ways gives a false impression of the worth of a person's possessions in their lifetime. Just through the process of archiving imparts this posthumous significance that those objects might not have acquired during the possessor's lifetime, obviously. And one of the things I think we've tried to do, not just with the John Cage book, is John Cage, Michael Foray book, but also some of the other archival books we've worked with, is attempt to discern what was of significance both in life and posthumously, and perhaps to strike a balance between what might be imagined as of significance and what might just be, and what might remain posthumously ephemera.
I'd like to add to that, just to make sure that we don't sound like we're burning archives, because it's really like, that's our thing, you know? But I think in that, what we'd had a few discussions with our, you know, archive artists, people that really work as kind of curators of found material or vernacular photography, things like this, where oftentimes it feels like if something is officially archived and put in the acid-free box and numbered and on a shelf, it has a very different way of living than something that gets put into, let's say, a reference library that'll move around and be handled and be sometimes annotated, even though they're not supposed to, or things that'll be collected. And I think the thing is when you're looking at someone's collection versus the archive, there's this possibility that it becomes static and protected. And a lot of artists are trying to intervene and say, what can I do to continue the movement that this archive was when it was a collection? Collections are meant to continue growing. They're meant to be organic in shape. There's a lot of home art collections that you see that people move things around. You know, the cliche is the Barnes collection, the way that the house was laid out, the way that things were constantly kind of contradicting a lot of rules. And there's a few examples of these types of spaces. And I feel like that's what you felt when you went through, if you're more versed in the archival kind of acid-free box open and imagine what this was in its original existence, you know, that's where it becomes really interesting because you have a broader picture. You see all the stuff that would have been on the table at Stony Point or, you know, at the loft in Manhattan, and then going, okay, well, someone who's absolutely obsessed with mushrooms, such a keen observer of this stuff, receives amazing art by some people and is like, whoa, this is great, and then also invites to a bunch of things he won't necessarily go to, and then a bizarre postcard from a friend that says, here's a clipping of a spore thought of you, and all of that lives together in this archive, you know. So some of it does really feel ephemeral, but the same way when you're going through your grandmother's box of ephemera, you find really significant notes. It felt a little bit like that, where we were kind of going through and there was so much stuff that was fascinating, but we were like, this doesn't help the story of, you know, what is the relationship with John Cage and mushrooms, and how did it kind of influence creatively his process and all these different things. But there was some great random
bizarre things.
Notes and postcards and photos of stuff that you're like, is that a spore? I'm not fully sure. And a lot of like erotica, because
a
mushrooms,
lot of erotica.
You know, and it was just like these insane images that we're like, do we include this? It feels a little, you know, off
personal.
Personal, you know, and it's kind of that thing where you want to stay true to the nature of what you found and try to tell these different narratives.
I think to also briefly add to that, Laura, there was a feeling slightly, a bit like if you read, you know, the wonderful Love Icebox book, it's an enormously intimate insight into a relationship, right?
Yeah.
And obviously the McHenry Library Collection felt at times a very intimate insight into John Cage's relationship with nature and the natural world.
Yeah.
And I think when we came to you, you really made that perspective more holistic in a way, because I know that your relationship with that collection was quite different to the one we had.
Yeah.
Or had.
I mean, it's like t-shirts of mushrooms, and like there's some bizarre ties that were like, for sure he never wore this. But at the same time, maybe someone he really loved gave it to him as a gag joke, and it meant more. And you can't really tell when you're looking at like a 1970s like polyester tie covered in mushrooms. You're just like, moving on, you know, like, but it might have had a story on it. And there's some of the things that it was really about seeing what the little signature on the back of it was and so forth. But we were quite weary. Something came up quite early on in editorial conversations with the team about, you know, treading carefully when it came to something that would feel like a scrapbook rather than something that really told the various narratives that we were going for.
And misassigning significance, I think, was a conversation we had quite a bit whilst developing the book. And with you too, Laura, actually, was misassigning significance to archival material.
Yeah,
right. You know, this is maybe going to sound off point a little bit, but I think it's right on point. And that is that when at the end of Cage's life, or not at the end, but a couple of years before he died, he was the Charles Eliot Norton lecturer in music in poetry at Harvard University. And he had a hard time figuring out what he wanted to do. Because it's really left wide open to the recipient of this award to speak on whatever they're going to speak on, except all they're told is that it has to be in some way autobiographical.
Okay.
And so he struggled with this for weeks and weeks and weeks, and I didn't have anything to do. And so the thing, one of the things that I did was I took money out of our petty cash can and I went up to the street to Barnes and Noble. And I was in graduate school at the time, so I was very academically minded and very critically thinking. And I went up to the Barnes and Noble and I spent, I don't know, $80, $100 buying him books, buying him things that just to kind of get the juices going in his body. So I bought him some Roland Barthes. I bought him Foucault. I bought him some Ben Shahn texts. I don't remember exactly what else, but man, I could tell you, if I look at his library today, I could tell you exactly what they were, because I brought them home. I was so proud because I thought they were going to unleash the beast. You know, they were going to just really get things going. And he looked at each one in turn. I can't say that he spent more than 20 minutes total looking at these 10 or so books that I had bought him. And then they went on the shelf and they were never, ever looked at again. Now, I'm coming to the real point of this story, is that fast forward 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, mm-hmm. and people look at John Cage's library, which right. we've so meticulously documented, and nowhere in there is a cautionary that says, Cage never read these books. He didn't like these books. He had an assistant who obviously had too much time on her hands
right.
and bought these books for him to read, but he didn't, he never read them. So what I do get are these little, you know, like a little French graduate student. Oh, I knew he loved Foucault. I just knew I could feel it in my bones. And she's so interested in these books that he read. And do I tell her? Or do I not tell her, you know? Because the truth is, I didn't tell her. And sure. I didn't tell her because I don't know about other books, you know? Right. There could be other books. There's a complete text of Goethe, for example. Cage never read Goethe in his life. I'm sure of it. Complete set of Goethe. And I'm sure that was a gift from someone. So it's the same sort of situation when you're talking right. about this little archive and these objects, that you either treat them all as sacrosanct and real or not, you know, but you can't pick and choose. So I wish I could have been a fly on the wall of your editorial meetings, you know. Do we put the tie in with the dancing mushroom babes? You know, do we?
So many photos of staff that we were just like really trying to document as much as possible because we were only given a certain window during which we could shoot things, which is also part of the way we work, is usually I come fully prepared to just document what we can so that we don't have to try to reschedule and do all these things. And honestly, we shot, you know, over 800 objects, just being like, we don't know, there might be a story here. Because as we're digging through, we're really kind of also, instead of doing an iPhone top shot of an object, you're taking a proper photograph of it, and it helps you kind of have a big picture. But, you know, that hard drive just basically sits there with, you know, we used really the photos that we knew we'd use, which were the field notes and the right. toadstools at home yeah. from, is it 1937? It was yeah. his personal copy, and it was the one thing I think that the archivist was the most excited about, that she set an appointment to be the one to handle it and open it, and it really felt like a special. She was so beautiful, and it had been rebound with string because it was coming apart, but by Cage. Like, it felt like something that really had been used to death, and he had annotated the outside cover, done all these things, so it was really wonderful to shoot it. And then we had to source a copy that was the closest edition to it, which was kind of fun to do, you know, the Abe Books kind of searches and eBay and so forth to find something. We were in the UK at the time, so it became more of a mission than planned, but basically just to try to see what that book held, because we hadn't been able to look at the full object so in depth at the archive, and that became its own mystery of like
right,
what to
right, call. Right.
You know, we were able to photograph the annotated parts and the pages that would open without altering the book.
I think just to add to some of that thinking, Laura, one of the thoughts that, you know, comes out, I think, when you look at archival material, particularly of, you know, not necessarily celebrities, but people who are in the public eye, is you wonder whether how aware they are of the fact that, A, there's sort of a posthumous assignation of value that happens to those artifacts, but B, they have now transcended into not only further into the public realm, but they're also now a public possession in a way, in the sense that anyone, and I think particularly you'd probably feel something similar, is that once you've passed away and your oeuvre and your body of work, it can become public property. And I think I often wonder that when we're in the archive, whether John Cage would ever have imagined that we would be poring over junk mail.
I think Kingston, it's a great question. And I honestly think, and probably he's the only person I would say this about, is that he hoped you would be poring over his junk mail.
Right.
You know, I don't mean that he hoped that you would have that much interest in him, but that he thought everything was important. Everything, you know, even junk mail was important. And one of the reasons that we had this process of these transfer files going to these archives was he couldn't bear the thought of throwing things out, of getting a notice by a beloved friend of a poetry reading that they did in Montreal, which of course he didn't attend, living hundreds of miles away, you know, but he couldn't throw it out. So he thought, surely someone will want to know about this sometime, you know.
And so, somebody wants the stamps and the membership cards, which is so sweet, but you can see that it's the same as, it's human nature to keep the things that you kind of feel this may document something, or this may just be a memory, like to hold on to what you can of it.
It also felt a little bit more like there's perhaps a parallel between what we know, and obviously you know more so, about his generosity of spirit. That is, you would give posthumously into the world of your material, whatever that might be, in the hope that it might inspire, exactly, some French graduate student to pour over your unexamined copy of Foucault.
And what's so amazing about that, Kingston, is that, you know, someday that dissertation is going to come out and it's going to be brilliant.
Right.
So if he didn't digest it, he could have, you know. We shouldn't take up more time on the archive business, because we could talk forever about the process of archives and people who work in archives. It's adorable. It's really an amazing space. And it pleases me no end that there's a publisher out there that is you, have this interest in archival materials, you know, and I won't call them lost materials, but sort of set aside materials that have gone elsewhere, not because they weren't valued or they weren't wanted, but Cage was literally buried in paper. Buried. I mean, that the apartment, before I got there, I mean, you know, the correspondence collection itself was, when he finally gave it over to Northwestern, comprised, you know, 17 file cabinets and, you know, covered 55 years of his life. So to just get that away must have freed him to write another string quartet, you know, just a little spurt of creativity just because of this beautiful little hole in the room.
Right.
So
right.
it was not, junk mail was my phrase. He did not say that. He did not say, this is all junk mail. And he didn't mean it derogatorily if he did. It was just stuff that had to go somewhere else, and he hoped that it would be of value. And the truth is about that ephemeral material, isn't it? A truth is that as a collection, when you look at those materials, you could get a very strong picture of what was going on in New York City in any given year across that period. You know, you can really get a feeling for who was the kingpin, who were the up and comers, you know. Anybody doing any kind of chronological study of that city would be a good thing for them to study that collection to look and see.
That's true.
It's a timestamp in a way. It's quite
exactly. But anyway, tell us about your book. So you stumbled upon this. Did you have interest in mushrooms yourselves before this?
The cliche is the mushrooms that we could get at the farmer's market. No, it's really that. It was anyways, personalities are also very much at play. So I have issues with trust of self-identification, you know, because it's very different. Because what was it that we told you? There was a woman that emailed us after having read the book and said, oh, I have this memory of going foraging with Cage and Lois Long, who was her childhood friend, and said that, you know, the story was that if he didn't know what something was, he'd eat it. And I was like, this is, to me, the idea of a horror story. It's really, you know, it's these kinds of ways about it. So I think for us, it was very much this has sparked more interest in it, but there's still this trust issue. And so we're looking into these different places where you can bring whatever you found to have it ID'd. And even then you're like, okay, that was nice. And then, you know, like still kind of growing them and so forth. But
I think to add to that, Laura, one of the things that, I mean, Pascal and I both came to Cage through his writing. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're aware of 433, and, you know, perhaps the more famous John Cage work, composition, excuse me. But that we'd really come to his work through his writing. And I think that's kind of where, you know, and then obviously working with you and bringing, you know, Mushrooms of Videocione and the Mushroom Book, is that we really come to Cage through his literature in a way. And the mycology element seemed, I think going back to what we said earlier, less expected, something we hadn't really thought about.
Yeah, Mushroom Book was something I was maybe more aware of from having researched, you know, artist books and smaller editions and these kinds of things, and through the art school past. But from the perspective for us, it was really about the fascination of someone with a kind of idiosyncratic, lesser known interest that was so overwhelmingly large. It's not like he, you know, sometimes liked to cross stitch in the evening, which is wonderful, and I really hope people should pick it back up. But basically, it was just something that was such a huge role. But he was this kind of big voice in amateur mycology, which also becomes interesting, but teaching it at the New School, all these different things. And so we had kind of this, you know, this superficial information about it. And then we knew that there was this work of the Mushroom Book that was proof that it had influenced a creative piece. And the question was, like, how far do these tentacles go? Like how far do the spores jump? You know, some mycology joke there. But basically, you know, is there something that we can really create a story with of a lesser known interest in a really well known and there's well trodden territory talking about.
You know, I told you this, but it bears repeating that when you came and you wanted to do this, I think I even said it out loud that everybody knows about Cage and mushrooms, everybody, you know. And it wasn't until I really reached out to a few select colleagues on the subject, not one of them didn't say back to me, oh, you'd be amazed. People really don't know a lot. And then I thought, well, maybe you guys are really onto something to do a book. You know, Mycological Foray has in fact piqued a lot of interest. It's entered the imagination of a lot of people since that book came out. You went into second printing right away.
Right.
Unexpectedly fast, right?
Yes.
That's something that we can count ourselves lucky and less lucky for, because it's the cowboy nature of reprinting that fast was interesting. But you know, if the demand is there and the interest is there, it's always exciting to see that people are so keen on it. And to an earlier note, it always is really lovely to make a book that can grab two very, very different audiences. Of course, there's a multiple audiences that you can go and get. But in terms of this book, you really see the Cage kind of dedicated fans and music dedicated fans. And then you just have these people that are so into mushrooms that this book just opens up a whole new world to them. And they, you know, they love it for the fact that now they can go digging around looking for more Cage material because they weren't so familiar with him. So it's always interesting to see those two come together.
It was very important for us, Laura, and I, you know, we spoke to you at length, I think, about this too, the idea that frequently, it seems a lot of Cage's work is post-rationalized and over-intellectualized and often made, rather inaccessible. And that seems very often counter to, I think, what we understand of John Cage's own mandates and own thinking about his own work was to be accessible and engaging and inspiring and, you know, and sort of devourable.
Mm.
And that we really sought to do that with this book, was to make that part of his life and thinking as accessible and also interesting.
I actually find Cage extremely accessible. You know, when I was in graduate school, when I did my doctoral studies, you have to do your orals, and you do right. an oral. Well, you know this, poor Kingston. You know this as well as I do.
Oh yeah.
But you study with each branch of the program that you're in, and then you take an oral exam with that person, or a written exam with that person. My composition teacher posed a question to me as my exam question, and he asked me to compare and contrast the piano works of John Cage with the piano works of Karlheinz Stockhausen. So I had to write an essay. I think I had 3 hours, you know, to write this essay. I don't remember too much about it other than to say that I wrote quite a bit about their performance notes that preceded the pieces, that Cage was extremely transparent, you know, that he tells you how the piece was structured, what the mathematical whatever was behind it, what his procedure was in composing it. And Stockhausen, it was absolutely impenetrable, you know, that you couldn't, or nothing. There might have been nothing for him. This, we're talking about a long time ago. But I want to say that was long before I really got to really work closely with Cage. It was right around the time I started to work with Cage. And I found it to be true all across the board that when I read anything that he wrote or listened to anything that he wrote and then composed and then read texts by him about them, they all made perfect sense to me. You know what I mean? It was an inroad. His words about his work were inroads into his work.
Yeah.
So I think you succeeded with the book, with the mycological foray, in opening a lot of doors for people. I think that may be part of its charm, part of its popularity, if you will, is that feel welcome. They feel welcome to the topic.
I think thank you, Laura. I think the sort of truth was, is that we wanted to feel as if they were, well, as you know, embarking upon a mycological foray into the imaginary landscape of John Cage's mind and thinking, accompanied by John Cage,
uh-huh.
you know, into an inner, more imaginary landscape of John Cage's mind, alongside John Cage himself as spiritual guide, if you will, as wandering companion, wayfaring companion.
To add to that, I think the idea also in approaching various archives and so forth, but especially something that has Cage's material so present throughout, is that he set the tone for the book. He was an active author. He was an active editor, even in the book, because you could read really, you could potentially read this book only by reading Cage words.
Yes.
And it would be a completely different book, but it would still work. You know, it would just be its own kind of meandering tale. So for anyone that hasn't seen the book, there's a certain brown earthen tint, that is all Cage writings throughout various pages, including the full transcript of Mushrooms and Variations. And basically, I think that's where we wanted to make sure that the book, you know, we use the word accessible quite often when we're working, but this one, it was really about saying, you know, how do we fit this tone? How do we complete this? How do we make it all feel like it really is a symbiotic object? And his words opened the book for a reason as well. It felt like, why have somebody else make a foreword to a John Cage book when he has the perfect text to contextualize what this entire book is going to be about?
Perfect. You know, this would be a really good time if you could briefly speak about the book. Like,
sure.
Describe it for people. Not everybody has seen it. Not everybody even knows about it. So this is your time to really explain the book. What is the book? What form did it take? What's in it?
So, John Cage, A Mycological Foray, Variations on Mushrooms, which is the sub, is a box set, actually. So it's a book that's made out of two main volumes. And the first volume is A Mycological Foray, which holds the essay that Kingston wrote that we were speaking of earlier, and that is built around interwoven indeterminacy stories of cages that do relate to mushrooms and nature. And also, you know, it's the foraging, meandering journey that also takes us through Cage's relationship with mushrooms from the beginning to his death. And then there's also a section of Mushrooms and Variation, Mushrooms in Variaciones transcript, which is 80 pages, 75 minutes. So a full transcript of that performance, which—
And that's a misostic poem. It's a very long misostic poem.
Yes, that's done in the same fashion as Themes and Variations. There's a little text in the book that also walks us through that. We print, it was from 1983, to excuse, but it's all on a separate paper, and that which has its own story. There's the foreword that we spoke of as well, which is a text by Cage that had been published in Silence, trying to remember the journal before that, which is...
The new...
Gosh, we should have pulled
it out. We should know what we wrote about.
But basically, there's also an appendix that explains the context of certain artworks or certain pieces that are found throughout the book, just to make sure that everybody feels like they can be swiftly brought up to date if they aren't necessarily as well-versed in a specific aspect of what's in there, and the archival materials that we were speaking of. So there's a selection of the quote-unquote ephemera archival photographs that were in the collection at UCSC, as well as photographs that we took of certain objects. And we'll also have archival images of Cage himself interacting with mushrooms.
Those images are William Gedney, yes?
William Gedney is the main archive. So the Duke University Archive gave us these beautiful images. And then there's the photographer, James Closte, who is a dear friend of Cage's, took a lot of great images of him out foraging. And also we have some Bruce Davidson images in there. And there's a John Fago image. As well, of Cage foraging. And then By the way,
Fago was the photographer who photographed Cage at Telluride at the Composer to Composer Festival, which I attended as a person who did the recordings. And this harkens back to something that Kingston was talking, or you were talking about, Pascal, just a minute ago, that Cage would go out foraging and then we would have these group meals. And there was this one particular night where he came back with a lot of mushrooms, but he wasn't sure what they were. And so he cooked them, and he and I were the only two people that ate them. And we didn't die, so we lived to tell. But you're right, he wasn't sure. Anyway, go ahead. It's lavishly illustrated, the book.
Yeah. Thank you. There's a few new illustrations that kind of complete the book, and those were done by a Canadian artist called Getsy Marie, and they're kind of etchings of various mushrooms to set the tone. But volume two is the pièce de résistance, so it's the first ever full reproduction of Mushroom Book, which is the artist book that we were speaking of that was made by John Cage and Lois Long. They also approached botanist Alexander Smith to add text about the mushrooms that were found within. So that's really a portfolio that's made up of 10 folios in which I'm just gesticulating a lot.
Gesticulating for listeners.
Great for radio. Basically, you'll have a John Cage lithograph that folds into a folio with a Lois Long lithograph of mushrooms. And within that, there's a very thin translucent sheet that has a transcript of some of Cage's writings and the Alexander Smith text about the mushrooms that are featured on Lois Long's beautiful
lithograph. Strata, aren't they? Strata.
Absolutely gorgeous. It's quite cumbersome.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful piece. And when you first, you know, raised the possibility of reproducing it, into a book form. It exists as an artist portfolio. So it's oversized. The sheets are singular. You can turn it very carefully. You can see everything laying the way Cage meant it to lay. So it isn't a book, it isn't a work by Cage that's seen very often. And even when it is, it's not exactly right, usually. It's framed separately. Pages can be solo. So I think you did a beautiful job. I think that Cage, it's one of the parts of the book I think that Cage would be the happiest about, because it really did bring something which was otherwise really unknown to people and give them an opportunity to actually see it.
Yeah, that's part of the idea of bringing, you know, artist books. Their paper works are always very difficult to keep alive, just period. And there's something really lovely about working with how to reproduce an artist book or something that was a bit more experimental in the way that it was unbound, and how do you put that into something that is to the art book, independent art book world, the mass market, even though we're obviously not, you know, making 20,000 copies of something, you know, we wanted to make it something that was still relatively affordable and that people could collect and have, but the nature of the way the book itself, the mushroom book itself exists, it had to be hand assembled. Even if a machine started doing some folding for us, there are hands involved in the process, which makes it really quite interesting, you know, from our perspective as publishers, to be able to be working with something that's still made by hand that way. And I thought that would tickle Cage, that there was, you know, all these hands involved in the process of making his book.
To add to that very briefly, Laura, and to what Pascal said earlier, there are numerous Cagean precepts, if you will, that guided a lot of the book's making. Not only, of course, the authoring of the text, but also the materiality, right? So, for example, a section of the book is printed on Katamela paper, which is a byproduct of apple production. So it's the pulp of apples, essentially, which, of course, has a Cage-related anecdote attached to that. But then, of course, the wrapping of the two-volume set itself is...
Oh, yeah. So we're in all honesty, complete eco-nerd, and it's not something that we try to make too much of a fuss about. But basically, the book was, you know, compostable shrink wrap. It's something that's relatively new, and we wanted to keep things as low kilometer as possible. So it was about sourcing it in the same region of Italy where we were printing, the same for Cartamella. It was made of the apple production in the apple production region of Sud-Tirol. So it's, in terms of publishing, it's the equivalent to eating 0 kilometer. This was very much like printing as low kilometer as possible and keeping everything really as kind of, what do you say, like to disrupt the least possible, you know, the local environment. So we're quite proud of that. And that really is, the Catamela came from, Mela being apple in Italian for those who...
Apple paper in Italian.
But basically, it's because we were so convinced that we would find an edible drawing of Cage's. So yes. One of his edible drawings that would just have a shiitake in it. We just thought we would find something that we could confirm had mushrooms. And it wasn't something that we were able to 100% confirm. So that was kind of part of the first conversations that we were having with you, Laura, was about those, because we were like, the hunch was, of course, there must be a mushroom in here somewhere. And the edible drawings are, I mean, they're a great object in and of itself, but the irony is that, you know, the conservation front of that is even lesser so than a paperwork, because it is made of food. Do you want to tell the story?
I actually just had a question for you, Laura.
What is your question? We have 1 minute left.
Oh. I'll speed my question up. What would you hope Cage admirers or Cage readers would take away from this book, and how would you encourage Cage admirers to progress forth into the future?
Yeah, but you know what? I think I've already said it in a way. It's, you know, for Cage, my mycology was about foraging. Somebody who knew him really well, long before I came along, said that he was a chow hound. And that his main interest in mushrooming and foraging for mushrooms was that he liked free food. You know, he liked the idea of free food.
Right.
And that's kind of, I mean, if you think, you know, if you can take yourself back that far, you know, you're saying this book that you came across at the McHenry Library, Pascal, you were talking about 1927 or 37, sorry.
Utopias at Home, yeah.
37. He was 25 years old. You know, he was 25 years old. He couldn't, he really didn't have a job. You know, he had had a wife. He was heading to not having a wife. You know, I think the life was challenging. You know, they were heading into a depression. So I think that foraging for mushrooms was a very physical, tactile way to communicate with his environment. You know, it wasn't a scholarly thing. And when he began to, you say he taught mushrooms at the New School. He really didn't teach mushrooms. Mm-hmm. He led mycological forays with people.
Right. Yeah.
And he met people who, that's our timer. He met people along the way, Guy Nearing, you know, people who were mycological foray people. Yeah, so you know, I like to think of the book, not think of the book, but I experienced the book as this opening, as this, mm-hmm. it shows him in situ. It shows him not with a microscope so much as with a pair of blue jeans on and muddy hands and a little right. basket. We still have his basket here at the Cage Trust if anybody would like to come and admire it. when we can have visitors again, of course, when it's safe to do so. But we have all of his implements, you know, so it was very much a part of his life, mycology was. And this book is enjoyed that way. It's enjoyed as an object that one enjoys in their life, as opposed to something that you put on white gloves to handle. You know,
right.
It feels friendly, it feels earthy. And your explaining about the apple paper was particularly beautiful. For those of you that maybe that didn't quite catch that, Cage himself made 3 series of edible papers or edible drawings. So he liked to say, just half kidding, that if they ever hit a famine, these collectors, they could eat their artworks because they were 100% edible. Anyway, it's been a great, great pleasure to talk with both of you. I wish we had more time. There's so many more things we could talk about.
Oh, no, we love chatting. We're chatty folks. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you so much. An absolute honor. Pleasure.
It's a pleasure as always. And we'll see you once we can get across that border again.
And I too. So whoever gets there first, the other side. Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.